You've stopped in at the Guidepost, brought to you by the American Saltwater Guides Association. Stock up on gear, grab a coffee at the counter, and get ready to hear incredible fish stories from the best captains on the East Coast and thought-provoking conversations with stakeholders and policymakers working to protect these fisheries. This podcast is presented by Costa Sunglasses.
What is up, y'all? Merry Christmas, happy holidays, happy new year, happy and joyful, whatever you celebrate and whatever applies whenever you listen to this episode. It's Captain Cody Rubner back in the hot seat with the mic, joined by my friend and lovely co-host, Tony Friedrich. And as we trudge our way through the final days of 2025, we figured we'd hop back on the mic and just do a little bit, not necessarily a comprehensive recap and not necessarily a major strategic look going forward, but a little bit of all of the above. I think this year was a wild and crazy year. I think every year in fisheries management that I've been a part of it, at least for the better half of the last decade now, has been crazy. But this one had its own flavor and its own stench towards the end. So happy to be back on here. Throw one more episode together. Got a couple cool ones on the calendar to kick off the new year. But this one will take us from 2025 into 2026. So without further ado, Tony, how are you feeling looking at the final hours of 2025 on the clock here? You know, I think the major theme when we were chatting right before this, I said, hey, what are these four or five things you want to hit? And all you said was ASMFC sucks. And, you know, it was really like, you know, part of me was like, yes, but also part of me was like, no shit, Tony, that seems to be every episode for the last 20. So how you feeling towards the end of 2025, my friend?
Well, let me just, Cody, is captains, are there, is time running out for the skiff giveaway?
It is. Yes. So depending on when you listen to this, you might miss that, but
if there's still time, enter the captain's skiff giveaway.
Yeah. World's finest skiff giveaway. Things badass. If you win it, please think of me and Tony.
Yeah.
For reminding you.
Absolutely. But it's, you know, it's just one of those things. They're a gritty, you know, boots on the ground, punch above their weight type of group like we are. And if you like us, you probably like them. So when you listen to this, run to their website. It's not much to enter. The raffle, you know, all goes to support captains, and you can win one heck of a skiff. So to get back into 2025, I'm going to scooch a little closer to my mic. I mean, holy crap, dude, what a morning. I think this morning is indicative of what 2025 was. Woken up at, Cody is a shepherd owner as well as I am. I was woken up at 3 o'clock in the morning by a frantic, drooling, panting shepherd, and the whole world became unhinged, and she's doing a little bit better now and not DEFCON 5 running to some emergency clinic that will charge me $1,000 as fast as I can give them a credit card. So thank God for that. But kind of a sign of like what the whole stinking 2025 was like. You know, stripers are our, you know, core. And when they started the latest management track, you know, we knew this was just a bullshit stall tactic that these people want to keep pretending that nothing's wrong and keep killing fish. And, you know, unfortunately it worked. There've been two or three crossroad points in the last 3 or 4 years where I think we'll all look back in 3 or 4 years and be like, yep, that's where you really messed up, you dunderheads. And, pretty disappointing. Fight is far from over. I can tell you a glimmer of hope. It is so cold in Maryland right now. It is already snowed like 3 times. When I walked out of the house at 5 o'clock this morning to get my giant shepherd Pepsid AC for her upset tummy, I think the wind was blowing like 30 to 40 miles an hour, and it was like 29 degrees. And yeah, man, it hasn't been this way in a long time. And I just think that we have had snows in New York and in Pennsylvania, and it's colder than all get out here. So unless something crazy dramatic changes, I really have a feeling that the environmental conditions may be more positive this year for a spawn, and we'll keep y'all up to date on that and what we're seeing. But what I can tell you is it is cold. Brutally ugly, nasty cold, and that's what we need. So, and it hasn't been this way for a very long time. So
and if it don't shake out when it comes to spawns, if it don't shake out this year, Tony, I mean, when is it, right? Like if it plays out the way it currently is and we don't get a good spawn, we're running out of let me rephrase, not we're, they're running out of scapegoats, right? You know, it's just the environmental condition. It's just this, it's just that. I mean, if this lines up the way that it's currently lining up and we don't get a good spawn, I don't know where else anything goes.
Yeah, I mean, 100%. And look, this has been our position since day one. It'll continue to be our position. You can complain about anything that you want, and I'm not saying that you're wrong. Environmental conditions, warming water, you know, whatever you want to say. Well, I don't have 100 years to fix something. I may not have 25. So I don't care. If that's what you think, that's fine. Then that's what you go advocate for. But we have one lever to pull that can make a difference. And those are size and creel limits and or harvest seasons. And that's it. And that can make a difference. And we have just consistently dropped the ball. And it's disgusting and it's sad. And I will say one other thing before we get into kind of the rest of the mess is, you know, you start to hear people talk about like socioeconomic impacts. Well, guess what? They don't know what they're talking about. I have an economics degree. And what I can tell you is socioeconomic impacts are not someone's home budget. Socioeconomic is the coast. And I hate to say it, but if a very small handful of people are saying that, you know, if you don't let us kill fish, we'll go out of business. I mean, you have a bad business model. I don't know what to say. That is not my fault. That is not your fault. That is not Cody's fault. We have killed too many fish for too long. Started when we went to two fish at 28 inches. That was the downward spiral. A lot of people have seen this coming for over a decade. Your poor business model doesn't change how we feel.
Well, it's socioeconomic, right? It's not personal economics.
Right.
So if there was a change to a local cultural standard or rule or whatever around here, regulation with me that put me out of business for guiding, but made the local community or the state community hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars, there are socioeconomic impacts there that influence its scale. Like, and the answer is, man, it sucks for me. And you hope that things can get, you know, you never want ill on anyone's way of making a living. But at the same time, socioeconomic impact does not mean the five people yelling at the microphone are scared they might make less money.
Can I give the listeners a moment of zen? I heard the best thing the other day. My social media algorithms are dialing me in. And it was this old guy kind of talking around a campfire. And he said, a honeybee does not waste his time telling a fly that honey tastes better than shit. The lesson in this is, don't waste your time. Some people don't want to hear the message. Some people don't want to know that honey tastes better than shit. And some people are perfectly happy with shit. And we're not. And I think in 2026, what you're going to see is we're going to come at this harder, more vocal. We're at a crossroads. And we will not be convincing people that honey tastes better than shit. They can figure it out on their own or not. We're not looking. Our policy, our lives have absolutely zero to do with getting approval from flies who enjoy eating shit.
And to be honest and to be fair to ourselves, Tony, we have not shied away from those discussions. That's been one of those things that I'm sure a lot of our social media followers have seen, we're not afraid of conversation, good, bad, or everywhere in between. And as long as someone, even if they completely disagreed with us, as long as someone was fundamentally respectful to us in conversation, we were not afraid and shied away from that discourse. I think what you're saying isn't a change to that MO. We're not afraid of discourse, but at the same time, there has to be a certain level of utilization of time and resources and manpower to start to focus on where change really can happen and let those that are just going to waffle on the sidelines do so.
Yeah. And that, you know, that message really goes, you see these arguments on social media and, you know, people send me a screenshot and say, you know, what about this? What about that? And the one thing that's common with the other side is they're completely wrong. They don't base anything on science. They'll say anything that fits their narrative. They're fools, and they're not on the right side of history. And the honeybee fly parable is really just to tell y'all, if you have a certain amount of time in this world to dedicate to conservation and you really believe in it, just ignore them on social media. I would much rather you read a stock assessment or attend a meeting or, you know, reach out to a biologist to understand something more and be a good advocate than waste your time telling a fly that honey's better than shit. Just think of that. Next time you see some crazy, you know, we've all seen them on social media, just look at it and be like, I guess that fly likes shit. And you'll feel a lot better and you'll walk away a lot easier.
The first person to comment a little honeybee emoji on one of our social media posts that we see, we'll send you a hat or something cool. No, I'm totally with you, Tony. When you talked about the basis of these conversations being based in science, this one's always difficult for me because you have, you know, your personal experience on the water, right? And a lot of people make sense that people base their opinion of something off personal experience. That's not a human flaw or necessarily a negative because it's happening on both sides of the coin with this. But we have to decide, like, okay, if we're going to have fair and honest discourse about a topic like a fishery, do these personal experiences count towards the conversation? You know, someone on that side might say, I'm seeing a lot of fish, nothing's wrong. Someone on our side might say, I'm seeing no fish, something is wrong. And I think I said that the opposite way, right? But, you know, they might say, there's nothing wrong, I'm seeing fish everywhere. Okay, so do those two points of personal experience contribute to this conversation? Yes or no? If so, then both of them have to be on the table. And if so, if they're both on the table, well, how do we quantify which one is worth more? In my experience and where our discourse is based in the United States of America on democracy would be, okay, well, then we're going to gather the people in the digital square. We're going to gather the people at these public meetings and we'll hear all the comments. And if way more people say it's bad than good or the vice versa, then that's how we'll take personal experience into account off of the numbers. And that is the other side of this coin has not played by any sort of those rules within those bounds, right? Because it's, I see fish everywhere. And if you don't see them, well, your opinion doesn't matter anyways. And, oh, we're doing this public comment. You need to listen that I'm seeing them everywhere. And, oh, thousands of people said things are in a bad place. Well, these numbers don't matter, you know, throw the public comment out. So does personal experience and personal public comment matter in this conversation? I believe it should. And that's why we have a democratic process where everyone can share their opinion. But boo effing who to the people who say, well, they might have had thousands of comments, but it's just the same old people. Okay, go find some other people who disagree. And if not, then let's wipe personal and anecdotal talking points completely off the slate here, and we're only going to go by the science. Both of these coins play in our favor, and the other side is just waffling. And so I hope that makes sense to anyone that's listening, but the reality is like, it just really pisses me off when the other side says, I'm seeing them everywhere, you guys just suck, and also your opinion doesn't matter.
Yeah, and the funniest thing is the same people who were saying that were running tog trips in New Jersey instead of striper fishing this fall. They were, you know, doing anything because the stripers really didn't show up. And And, you know, look, here's the deal. The numbers show that live releases are down like 84 to 86%. Even if they're off, which direction are they off? Or are they even less than that? Are they overestimating? Because we know they're overestimating. Or are they underestimating? Are you comfortable with live releases being down 70%, 65%, 50%? I mean, just enough is enough.
They're not trying to have honest conversation, Tony. That's the issue.
And here's the one thing that's just true, and I think this is a good segue to get into Redfish in the South Atlantic. The one thing that's true is that a lot of these managers are straight up, flat out cowards. Some of them aren't. You know who you are if you aren't. We talk to you. But they're just cowards. They just don't want somebody to yell at them. You know, if you look at the personality of somebody who would work in like a state agency, it's not really, or like a federal agency, it's not an entrepreneurial mindset. It's, let me do my time, let me get my pension, you know, the longer I work here, the less chance I get fired, that kind of thing. And it's kind of like, go along to get along. Not really like fire and brimstone. Yeah, there's a few. But,
I mean, we've literally heard, for anyone who's like, hey, man, he's putting people in a box, you know, my uncle or I work at the state, whatever. We've literally heard from people's mouths that exact statement, Tony. Like, ah, I've been here for a while, and I'm just trying to get to the finish line. I'm not shaking the
tree. Oh, my gosh. Listen, word for word, we have heard that it's easier, let them just collapse, and we'll redo it from there. I'm tired of getting yelled at. I don't know. Have the conversations with the people. Become friends with them.
Hey, man,
that's what I hear.
Your loved one's a drug addict, and we got to get him off, you know, ASAP. Just let him OD again, and then we'll restart all this once he's in the hospital. If you heard something, you'd be like, that's disgusting. That's a disgusting perspective.
Yeah, and that's...
And it applies here. They're playing with your lives. That was a
morbid
example.
Pretty much how I feel.
But they're playing with your lives and your businesses.
So I think this segue to Redfish is pretty solid because, you know, the Redfish issue is brand new in the South Atlantic. They haven't done any management whatsoever in a quarter of a century. And, you know, particularly Georgia had a lot to give. They have a 5-fish limit. Florida, I'm kind of going to leave out of the criticism for a moment. I'm going to leave out of the criticism because they regionally manage these fish. Some of them, you know, they have places where there's no harvest, places where there's one fish. You know, Florida's got a lot of information on redfish. Now, that said, South Carolina had a little bit to give, and Georgia had a little bit to give. And rather than do the right thing, you know, redfish are managed on what's called spawning potential ratio, and that's what percentage of an unfished stock is out there, you know, sexually mature, ready to go, ready to spawn. And they, instead of cutting the regulations and doing the right thing, they lowered that bar, which would be like lowering the reference points for striped bass. And the craziest thing is it was, I don't know, 300, 295 to one. Those are the comments to not lower the bar. And frankly, I mean, I don't really have another word for him. A tool bag from Georgia, Doug Haymans, said that we didn't know what we were talking about. That's what he said on the record. And then furthermore, Chris Bat Savage from North Carolina tried to make a motion. And, you know, they play by Robert's rules, and Doug wouldn't let him make a motion because Doug's the chairman. Well, so hold on, let me get this straight. Or like, we only do Robert's rules when it works for you, when you can twist it up and confuse people and make a sub motion and another motion and 5 motions are on the screen and nobody knows what the heck is going on. Because not allowing Chris to make that motion, well, he had an alternate motion if his motion failed. So it's just, I mean, that was, to me, that was the biggest sign of like, we're going to do whatever we want and we don't care, that I've ever heard in my life. And guess what? Doug Haymans is a coward. He's a political hack. I've heard that from countless people. And there's one or two legislators in Georgia who threatened that if anything happened with redfish, they would put a bill in the Georgia legislature that would take the regulatory right from Georgia DNR. And anytime that they had to make changes to size creel limit seasons on fish, that it would have to go through the legislature. So my point in all this is like, you feeling froggy? Jump. Like, you're already controlling Georgia DNR. You're already controlling it from your little perch in your uncontested district in Georgia that has 8 rural people living in it. No, seriously, like, look at some of these places. Like, they win their uncontested, then they win their election with, like, 700 votes. And that person is going to be able to dictate how redfish are managed on the whole coast. And no one at South Carolina DNR has the gumption to stand up and be like, hey, you know what? No, this isn't right. You know, and prove me wrong. But right now, every single thing that I've heard, every single thing that I know about the issue, and I know quite a bit, and I can keep going if you want. You're a coward, and you did the wrong thing for redfish because you're more interested, you're in your self-interest, because you don't want to get yelled at by a legislator who won by 700 or 1,000 votes. And we're going to dovetail this real quick, Cody. I see, you know, you want to say something, but I want to dovetail this into Menhaden, because this is where I am going to criticize Florida. So when all that information came out for Menhaden, allegedly the governor of Virginia made a lot of phone calls to the Republican governors in the South, in South Carolina, Georgia, and Florida, and said, well, if you don't vote this away on Menhaden, we're going to get the NAACP on you. And that's because the union that the workers at the Omega plant in Reedville, Virginia work for are part of a union that has a lot of influence with the NAACP. And allegedly, at the happy hour, you know, where they give themselves awards and pat themselves on the back for destroying our fisheries coastwide, at the happy hour, there was a lot of discussion that was out in the open that the response from the southern states was, oh yeah, sure, we'll vote your way on Menhaden, you vote our way on redfish. Mic drop. That's, and prove me wrong. Because it's, you know, when one person says something, it's, you know, you kind of take it with a grain of salt. But when half a dozen people who you trust tell you the same thing, same name, same players, same location, exact same thing. This is not how fisheries management works, right? This horse trading BS. And, you know, to dovetail that into Menhaden, now you know, allegedly, why all of these southern states that basically have no Menhaden quota are voted against the updated assessment for Menhaden. And then the last thing that I'll say, Cody, and I'll just let you riff for a while, is really horrible to see some of the conservation-minded states in the Northeast, like Maine and New Hampshire, fold like a deck of cards because they want lobster bait. And that's the problem with these ecological reference points. So see, it works both ways. So if you have a robust striped bass population, you need more Menhaden. But if the striped bass population is in the shitter, well, all you need to do now is say, golly gosh gee, the Chesapeake Bay can't support striped bass anymore, and we're going to have to lower the reference points. Well, guess what that means in math gymnastics? They can kill more Menhaden because they'll never be the same amount of striped bass. And all this is going on with the benchmark stock assessment 2027 for stripers, with, you know, over half a decade of failed spawns. And when you start to see, like, these states that you used to rely on for conservation turn tail and run because they're completely controlled by the lobster industry, and the lobster industry wants to destroy another forage species for bait for their mindless pursuit of lobster, which, by the way, are also in the shitter, completely in the shitter. It's pretty, like, you kind of just feel like you're the last person on the field standing with like a marauding horde of barbarians coming down the mountain at you. But it doesn't bode well. I mean, here's the deal. Here's the bottom line. Are you a quitter? Who are you? You know, when stuff gets tough, are you going to be like, wow, we don't have a chance, I'm just going to walk away? Are you the kind of person that's like, I'll walk right up to the gates of hell and spit in the devil's eye? I don't care. I'm going to keep going because this means something to me. And you know what? Taking a loss or whatever, that's all part of this deal. But you keep coming back and you keep coming back and you keep coming back. And I promise you, you'll win. So, oh, and by the way, the last thing I'll say before you get going, Cody, is like this all started with lobster. They didn't want to take an increase the size of a width of a penny over a lobster stock assessment that took forever. And, you know, through a hissy fit, literally a conniption fit, ended up getting Pat Kelleher had to retire early because he went back to defend one of his employees. And, you know, like, I don't know. Eat crawfish. They're better anyway. That's what I would have to say. You hop online, you get a sack of crawfish delivered to your house. It's crawfish season is coming up. Eat some damn crawfish. They're better. And, you know, these, it's unbelievable that one group can have so much power that nothing matters. Everything is blinded. And I mean, let's face it, man, the striped bass industry is worth way more than the lobster industry. They're just not as organized. So maybe that's on us. Maybe it takes time. Maybe we're not doing a good enough job. Maybe we need to do more. That's kind of our answer for everything. Do more. But it's not like the lobster industry is worth more than the striped bass industry, not by a long shot. So, you know, what a mess. What a mess in the Atlantic. So Cody, if you want to just, you know, let loose on all that mess, and then we'll get into menhaden in the Gulf.
Well, being a resident of Florida, I'll take a quick counterpunch on the Florida menhaden topic. I mean, what's gross to me, Tony, is you have precedent in Florida from 95, so 30 going on 31 years ago. But three decades ago, Florida made a decision on the net ban, right? And that was a massive, massive decision for Florida, very controversial, and pushed all heavy gear, high bycatch commercial fishing off of the beaches. Why? Because they knew the value of snook and redfish and tarpon and all the other fish that were getting gobbled up, their value to their state's economy, to the angling economy, to their angling tourism, and saw the benefit in spades to other specific inshore fisheries that bounced back, that were really getting hit hard by it. So you have a state that has personally recognized, wow, this is doing a lot of damage to within the valuable fisheries within our backyard. And then they're going to put this same voting decision of being pro-industrial menhaden fleet. I mean, it would be one thing if a state like that abstained from voting. And we don't really have a dog in the fight here. This is a massive decision for these specific states that are really, you know, their stakeholders or in their livelihoods are really significantly influenced. And so we'll bow out. And that kind of almost leads in to, I don't know if you threw the feds under the bus yet, but if not, we're going to have to in a second. But there's one thing to be said if someone abstains, and abstaining can affect a voting decision in a significant way. You could really, man, we almost won this. I wish Florida voted with us. I wish NOAA voted with us. But if their role, they said, because of these reasons, we're going to stay out of it and let these other people decide that, then there's something to be said for that. It's not always respectable, but there's still something to be said for that. When they go on the record against, it's just unfathomable. Like, how did you get yourself here? And, you know, I've got some choice words, probably some that I can't air out on the podcast, but just really disappointed as a, I'm not even going to talk from ASGA right now. I'm going to talk as just Captain Cody Rubner, just a small business owner, an angler, an outdoorsman, an advocate. I have tried my best to play ball by the rules, respect everyone, respect where people come from, respect how people view things differently, and respect the system. Understanding that systems are not perfect, you and I and all of our listeners know there are a lot of errors in the management system and in the science system. I have a degree in marine biology. I love and respect the science side of all of these conversations, and the people who devote, some of my closest friends are well-respected scientists or working their way and really taking the humble approach towards, you know, they don't make a lot of money, they have grueling hours. They're doing it because they love it, and because they have the passion to continue to learn about our fisheries, about our oceans, and that information, when done the right way, is foundation for really impactful conversations like this. So I have so much respect for science, and I tried to show the regulatory process a lot of respect. And so you and I have sat in rooms, at different times, but both of us have sat in rooms in Virginia, in DC, with high-ranking officials that represent the federal government and federal scientists. And when we have heard, hey, we think MRIP is off by a lot, we didn't even rip them a new one. So yeah, well, we kind of assumed, here's how we can have a productive conversation. Here's how you can try to improve data, collecting data. Here's how you can try to improve the relationships with your constituents who are really upset with how this whole data process is played out. Don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. Let's keep this together. Let's figure out state and federal partnerships. We have tried to show an immense amount of respect to these people.
Oh, Cody, wait. Our first statement when they were like, yeah, MRIP's trash. We messed up by 40% because we got the questions in the wrong order. Our statement, if you go back in that blog, was, this is unfortunate, but this is also science. And we actually gave them an attaboy for
having the courage,
being honest about it and trying to make it better. And that's the truth. And I don't know, it's so much easier to just trash somebody and be like, look, numbers, data is bad. Like, that's so base and easy, and we try to take the nuanced approach. And let's be honest, you know, the decision at the end of October, beginning of November on striped bass, you know, we have this nuanced position, and tell everyone exactly, you know, do this, do that, this is why. And the position that we were fighting was status quo. And that's it. That's a lot easier position to push. And, you know, all I can say is we try to do the right thing by the fish all the time. And watching, you know, when you go to, I don't think there's anything worse, you know, in like man code. There's nothing worse than like one of your friends messes up and then you stick up for them because they're your friend. And then
they do it again.
Week later, not even they do it again, like they do it again and then spit on you.
Double down.
And then you're like, well, I guess that's over. And that's, you know, watching the federal agencies, lest we forget there was a government shutdown.
Right.
During that striper meeting, and they're there combing the hallways, telling people how to vote. Like, where did that come from?
You know? Totally lost me from everything I was just talking about, it from personally, this is from Cody, of how I have viewed this and how I've tried to participate in these conversations. The federal agency, you lost me. You totally lost me. How could you justify the way that you have voted in the last two meetings? It's disgusting. And nowadays, no one friggin' works anyways. So when you have people, you know, half the time you try to go put money in the bank, they're closed. Half the time you're trying to get a hold of someone, a state or federal employee, and they got this day off because of this or this because of this. And so at all the times that we have tried to collaborate and do productive discourse or community efforts to try to rally or to inspire or to educate and all the things, all the roadblocks that we have hit with working with the federal government throughout the years. And then during the government shutdown, magically, not only do you show up with the courage to work while unpaid, but you show up with the courage to instigate a campaign against conservation. Just totally disgusting. So it's not going to change where I went with this. It's not going to change, obviously, how ASGA participates in these conversations or how we respect the rules and the system and play ball to try to get things done for the fishery. The end game is the fishery, not ego. And we would never hold anything against anyone in a way that would drive us to act outside of the best interest of the fishery. So to make that very clear, you know, Florida, boohoo, the feds, boohoo times 10. A couple times I've personally tried to lean into the feds and report something or do something, just have always hit a brick wall. But was really nice after, you know, weeks of trying to rally people and educate people and get them, make sure that they have the tools to participate how they want to. Very nice for the feds to go put one giant brick in the wall that stood in the way of that. So those two, upsetting Tony, and then I guess I'll end my ramble. You touched on Maine a little bit, and Maine's been in the news. I don't know if you've been watching, Tony, but for a very unique reason.
My God, it's almost like we planned this. This is, man, we're just going from one topic to the other. Please continue.
So I went to the University of Maine, lived in Orono, interned with the Department of Marine Resources. I worked on the fish ladders there. I did my capstone research on sturgeon. I've fished Maine everywhere from, you know, native trout waters, fly only, to hand lining northern pike that are invasive through the ice in a Celtics jersey, right? Like, I love Maine. I love everything. People don't understand how incredible the angling opportunities are in Maine. I won't dovetail right now, but I'll CC Oxbow Brewing Company's All Species Tournament, and the fact that there's a tournament where you can win it by catching 16 species on the fly in 36 hours. I mean, that is what Maine is. And Maine manages their fisheries. They are very, very, very strict with how they manage their fisheries. The wardens mean business. I mean, if you are ice fishing without a license, and you walk out and they say, "Hey, Tony, did you catch anything? Nice to meet you, sir. Did you catch anything?" You go, "No, man, I was just out there with my buddy. I wasn't fishing." They'll say, "Well, I was standing in the woods for the last 2.5 hours at 11:37 a.m. roughly. I saw you handline something in and throw it back. So what was that?" I mean, the wardens up there, they're nice people. If y'all have seen whatever the show was that used to be about Maine wardens, they mean business. And a lot of that stuff is freshwater based. Obviously, the saltwater stuff is managed in different capacities and commissions and such. But Maine truly, to their core, is out to protect their wild and native fish. And then they have a bunch of other programs, you know, supplementary stocking programs for put and take fisheries. You know, we raise brookies and put them in this pond that people can fish for them. And as many of you know, ASGA is not pro stock supplementation when it comes to stocking, but for, you know, freshwater is very different. If you're dropping stuff in a pond, so people get a chance to catch fish with their kids and pass on the love for fishing. I mean, Maine is a heritage-based state. They're one of the states that's like, you know, when you're born, you get your L.L. Bean boots and you get your lifetime fishing license. Like, that's going to be your Christmas gift when you're 3 or 4. Right now, there is a campaign by the lovely organization that did the same Yes on 2 push for the right to fish and hunt in Florida. And they were not a fan that we had a nuanced perspective on that stance. We didn't just pick yes or didn't just pick no. We said that we were no specifically just because of the wording. We didn't like the wording of how it was, but we were not against the concept of the right to fish and hunt in Florida. And we got, you know, every vile statement under the sun hurled back at us saying, just say, you know, you guys are anti this, 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 this. Well, that same organization is now leading a campaign, Tony, to open up many of Maine's fly fishing only waters. And their theory is that it is based on elitism and that Maine only has fly fishing only waters to restrict lower income folk from enjoying the resource, and that Maine's right to food law demands that the lower working class of Maine have access to spin fishing all these waters. If, you know, I try to play ball sometimes, but you're a bozo. You're a complete and total bozo. Anyone that is leading this campaign, you're an absolute bozo. The entry level to fly fishing in Maine is cheaper than it's probably ever been, and you can actually get quality stuff for cheaper, fresh out the box.
Well, the guy, the video on the news, the guy was in a $50,000 bass boat.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's not the guy who is filing the lawsuit. So that it just doesn't ring true. And like, look, man, look.
It's disgusting.
Here's the deal. We have been managing specifically trout streams for eons that are either catch and release, fly artificial only, no bait, seasons. You know, I was talking to my nephews in the White River, and they close big areas of the river when the browns spawn. They know exactly where they spawn. You know, there are rivers, tons of rivers, you know, 2 hours, 2.5 hours west of me that are fly fishing only, that are, you know, no bait. You know, one of the most famous rivers like that is Hoosima, what's it? Big Hunting Creek and Owens Creek, which flow right around Camp David. and you can walk those streams and you can see where presidents from the 40s and 50s etched their initials into a tree. That those streams are tiny. You could jump across them in some places, and they cannot sustain people coming out with night crawlers and throwing in for these trout. I mean, it'd be wiped out in a week. And the other thing is, you can go to Walmart. I have two Walmart rods right here. The yellow, I guess they're the Eagle Claw rods. They're $39 or $29 on sale. And that's what I had. That's what I taught my son with when he was itty bitty, so he didn't break a really nice rod.
They come rigged up with like a cheapo line, dude, and you get like six flies with them too. Dude, you know?
It's that is just a narrative that is so untrue. The average surf caster, their equipment is probably on par with the average fly fisherman. And I can tell you what, dude who filed the lawsuit on his bass boat with his trolling motor and his sonar, I think has a pretty significant advantage to some guy in waders with a moderately priced fly outfit. And it's just, you know, the argument is just such a crock of shit. And it divides the fishing community.
It wastes and time and resources.
It makes people hate each other.
It's divisive. And it's all about, you know, go look at this International Order of Teddy Roosevelt. Go look at their website and see who they represent. Go see who they represent.
Well, they don't have one fisherman. There's not one fisherman on that entire website. Not one.
It's like, you know, antelope safari hunting quest of whatever. And again, we're not anti-harvest. Both of us like to keep fish or hunt or provide for ourselves.
Lovey, I didn't give out the Christmas bonuses this year, and I have an extra $50,000 to go shoot an elephant.
Yeah.
In a concrete water pit on a savanna where there's no water for 100 miles. Maybe I'll get lucky and get a kudu too, Lovey. I'm supporting conservation. Like, stop it. You want us to go after you? Think twice about it.
And we're not pro. This is not a, well, fly fisherman, whatever. If one of our guides in Louisiana said they wanted to make redfish catch and release fly fishing only in Louisiana in the bayou to ensure that, you know, release mortality was low, we'd also say that person is a bozo, because a redfish can eat like freaking six treble hooks, take like one of these jackasses bow hunting in the middle of the night who misses. You know, you can see a redfish chasing mullet or chasing menhaden with like a broadhead sticking out of the middle of its forehead, right? So the coin applies both ways. Don't be a bozo. Cut the shit. You're wasting. People are already so worked up and so they don't know what to believe. They don't know what to fight for. There's so many things that are worth fighting for, and people just don't have the time. They're trying to pay their bills, spend time with their kids, take care of their family, chase their career dreams, whatever it may be, stay healthy and stay alive, all these things to worry about. And then you're just taking up time and resources. To the newscasters that gave this airtime, you're a joke. You're a complete and total joke. You're only giving it airtime because you know it'll rile people up and get 10,000 comments on Facebook. Because, you know, the last post about fentanyl overdose in downtown Lewiston, like, that didn't get enough clicks. So now you're the right to fish and hunt in Maine for spin fishermen because the fly fishermen are keeping the poor people out. I knew people who made bread in Maine. I knew people who came from nothing in Maine. I know fly fishermen and spin fishermen and ridiculously avid outdoorsmen and skilled outdoorsmen who, being an outdoorsman or outdoorswoman, runs in their family. It is a part of their culture. I know people from all levels of economic income that runs in their blood in Maine. You're a total jackass. If you end up listening to this or anyone from your organization and you want to come on and have this conversation about this current campaign in Maine, be our guest. I'll be incredibly respectful and we can have a discussion. Let's have a discussion. You're having these discussions with a newscaster who you probably told, here's the five dumb questions to ask me. If not, they went on ChatGPT and said, this is going on. What are five questions I should ask?
Well, come have a conversation with people who do this. But think about some other cascading effects, like, I don't know, Maine runs a moose lottery. Imagine if they want to open up the barn doors on that. Maine has some fantastic grouse hunting. Not exactly easy to do that. You need dogs. You need to train the dogs. You need to be willing to walk through some of the harshest woods that God put on this earth, up and down mountains and through brambles and just nasty stuff. And, you know, look, here's the deal. What happened? There are very influential, powerful, very deep-pocketed groups that are just anti-regulation. They're anti-regulation.
Yes.
And look, I mean, to my left here, I'm looking at my gun cabinet. The average age of my shotguns is like 110 years old. They are basically antiques.
So you got them when you were 10?
Yeah, yeah. No, they are. You were talking about family pride and stuff like that. And they could come out with the greatest shotgun in the world tomorrow, and it could be $2, and it's the greatest thing, and you never miss, and it has auto-aiming AI and laser beams and whatever. And I would pick up my 1911 Browning Belgium A5 Sweet 16, and that's what I'm happy with.
Well, the gun you just described is someone from that order would probably take that to go shoot the last, like, pygmy elephant. Like, the RPG took its head off. Oh, it stinks. Leave it in the field. I want to go home, Jeeves.
Like, you know, man, there's something to be said. If you don't think, here's the bottom line. Generally speaking, stereotypically speaking, it is harder to catch stuff on the fly than it is on bait or conventional. It's harder. So that's one. Two, because it's harder, you have to commit yourself to it. And you have to kind of take it on the chin and be like, you know what? I'm not going to catch as many fish as I used to catch, but that's okay because I want to do it this way. And then along that process, when you're trying to get better, I think it develops a core inside of you where you respect the fish and the fishery because you are putting so much time into it. And that develops into a conservation ethos. And I'm not saying you don't have conservation. I mean, the same thing could be said for striped bass surf casters. Like, look, you're standing in freezing ass water, having waves beat the bejesus out of you. You're in a spot. You can't put a key in a boat and go, you know, 100 yards, 150 yards beyond where you can cast. And that's where the fish are breaking. And you have to know more if you're a surf fisherman. It's the exact same thing. There's so many commonalities, it's unbelievable. You have to know more. You have to put your time in. You have to know on what beach, on what tide, on what moon, what wind. And when all that lines up, you know, and that takes time and experience. And it's not just picking up a cell phone and being like, where are the fish breaking? I'm going to fire up my two 250s and you'll see me coming at you at 45 miles an hour. That stuff doesn't exist. And it should be respected. It should be respected that, you know, basically you're playing tennis with an 8-foot net. And you chose to do that because, frankly, you know, it makes you a better fisherman. Because so, like, here's the last thing that I'll kind of say about it is, like, if you take that path, ultimately, I think it's because you want to be better. If you just want to go out and catch the biggest fish every time, you know, and pick up a cell phone and ask your buddy where they're at, you know, that's fine if that's the enjoyment that you get out of it and put the picture up and all that kind of stuff. And it's not like nobody respects you for that or whatever, but like it's the quiet people who you don't see on social media that put the time in, do it the hard way. My gosh, I mean, that's so much more rewarding And because of all that, you know, Maine has these rules, and that's why Maine has such an incredible resource.
Because, and like the last stronghold of like
eastern. Well, who the hell wants to walk 4 miles up a mountain to catch a 11-inch trout? I mean, holy crap, like that.
Native trout in the United States is few and far between. Continuing to do, you know, we work in saltwater, but native fish and protecting native fish is a massive thing. And the state of Maine is huge on it and how they handle invasive species and what they're doing. You know, the whole goal is to make sure that there's those fish are left. It has nothing to do even with, even if you want to boil it down just to the management standpoint, everything you're just talking about is true. But even some of that stuff doesn't apply to the management of, they're making these rules just so they exist so that we don't wipe them down to zero. Because how would these small streams that have such a small confined population, it's not like more come in with the tide, they are landlocked. How would a freshwater fish, where are they going to go? And how are they going to take the burden of, like, if these opened up and all of a sudden there's 100 MEP spinners ripping through there, you know, a day for the entire open season.
On a brook trout.
They'll suddenly be gone. They'll suddenly be gone. And so what the two things that piss me off is, one, you're weaponizing things that people care about. People who don't have steady income, people who are struggling to feed their families. That's a real thing in the United States. And I feel for people who struggle and who have to deal with that burden just to provide for themselves. And a lot of people have drawn a lot of really shitty hands and they're there and it's not their problem too. That's not what's going on here. And it's disgusting that you're weaponizing it, because if you cared about feeding people more and off the basis of the right to provide for yourself there, okay, well, there's no caloric difference between a native brook trout that's in a fly fishing only stream in the woods that probably takes a shit ton of resources just to get there compared to a stocked fish. So your campaign should be nothing to do with open amp waters and just get the state to double down on the amount of brook trout that they put in a Pushaw Lake and every other lake.
Forget about brook trout. You ever seen an 11-inch brook trout? I mean, it's not even like a chicken finger. What's the big deal? If that is the true reason to feed yourself, last time I checked, Maine was up to their necks in giant brim, smallmouth bass. Like, there are plenty of fish that offer a lot more meat. I mean, look, dude, go catch a stringer of brim. Go catch a stringer of crappie. There's so many opportunities. It's unbelievable in Maine. Why do you have to pick on this delicate little char that is basically like just untold amounts of money have been thrown at this fish to keep them native? They've been there since the Ice Age. You know how susceptible they are. You know how delicate they are. And that's your flagship? That's what you're picking?
Well, it's like, because it's not what they care about. They're just weaponizing stuff. And then the last thing I'll say on this is, what it also upsets me, Tony, because we work so hard on these other fisheries, and this stuff can have, I think you said this already, cascading effects, right? Like, this just riles up a bunch of people. From what I've seen online, it's 90-something% people are like, I fly fish, I don't fly fish, I'm this, I'm that, this is all stupid. A lot of people are with us, but, you know, what really upsets me is this will embolden 10% more of people, 15% more of people who hate regulation, like you said, that this is just all off the basis of regulation. And those are more people who will just speak up and comment and do this and do that and get involved in a conversation like striped bass, right? First, they're going to shut down all my rivers to fly fishing. And now, you know, a moratorium's on the table and they're not going to let me keep a striped bass. Da, 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 da. You're just muddying the waters for everyone else trying to do good. And that's why it's just despicable. And if you're anti-regulation, go start with something else. Go start with another regulation that's in place that's making nobody's life better or more impactful or not saving any resource. Go start there. Stay the F out of this. This is an embarrassment. And all the negative PR and backlash that you get, you know, if that organization is leading other campaigns in the hunting world that are positive, that are better, well, guess what? If that's the case and I'm not aware of it, you're just putting a giant stain on your organization. And that's assuming that there's positive work helping, happening other places. So
total embarrassment. It's disgusting. I think that's like my 15th time using that word today. But, you know, we had to jump on that really quick because I think it's in the news and people are always curious about how this stuff plays out. I hope that it completely eats total shit as it gets to any sort of hearing, any vote. I think any main scientist with a lot of history or main manager that knows what's going on, that has fought for Brook Trout and et cetera for years, I hope you get on a mic, get in the boardroom. When you're in these legal meetings, you rip them an absolute new one for how stupid they are. And that I hope you get just desserts on this campaign.
Well, Cody, let me put a little gravy on the taters for this. Is, you know, this kind of stuff sets precedent. You know, can you imagine a river out west, or like, I don't know, what about upper branch of the Delaware? You know, other places that aren't like Maine, that have easy access, that have, you know, not as many resources, that have a lot higher of a population, and this sets some kind of precedent. And the next thing you know, I mean, look, man, I think SNP, like Shenandoah National Park, dude, that place is just lives on a razor's edge. It is little teeny tiny trickles of mountain brooks that have native brook trout, again, that have been there since the ice age. And it's kind of like the southernmost reach of these fish where they're native. And that would be completely and utterly obliterated in, I don't know, 6 months, maybe less. And like, for what? For what? It's, I don't know. Like, I just don't understand it where you, I think the story is this, is that any time that you see any issue in this world, I don't care what it is, and there's 10% of people on either side of the extreme, and they're pushing for it, and like 80% of the people are in the middle, and both the 10% on other of the extremes seem just batshit crazy. And that 80% of the people in the middle don't voice their thoughts. They don't participate because they're quiet. They just want to be left alone. They just want to do their thing. And I would say that 80% of the people in the middle is like kind of who we want to represent, where we educate you and try to motivate you and explain to you why it's important to get engaged if you love this stuff. Anytime that you see one of these issues, just look at those extremes and say, that's not me. I'm a little more nuanced than that. I try to educate myself on it and then kind of be a part of the solution, because this country is just one extreme after another. And that's not a place where conservation can live. So if you live in Maine, if you fish Maine, if you care about Maine, I think this is worth getting involved in. And it'll be something that we talk about, even though this is freshwater stuff. It has, you know, pretty large implications on just fisheries as a whole. And to be honest, we have a lot of friends in Maine that support us, whether it's fly shops or Oxbow Brewery. You know, it's a great state with great people, and this is going down the wrong road. And I would just suggest to the judges and the attorneys and whoever else is going to be listening to this in Maine is like, fight hard, because this isn't just about Maine. This is about a lot more than just Maine. And it's just stupid. It's just stupid. If the brim, bluegill, whatever you want to call it, population is doing great in a lake, ramp up the limit. I don't know. Like, there are fish that are food fish, and there are fish that are not food fish. I don't know. I don't know, Cody. Like, I've been pretty poor. I've had a hard time. I've been in the position of a lot of these people where you don't have money to pay bills and you don't know what's going on. I mean, my 20s were just one disaster after another. And I have deep empathy and compassion for anyone in that situation. But I also know that if you can go to a lake and catch 25 big old fat 10-inch brim, you're going to do a lot better than catching a couple of brook trout in a stream if you really want to eat. That's just where this whole thing is just a lie. It's
dude, I was broke. I was broke when I lived in Maine. I was a college student. We had no money. And if you wanted food on the weekends, when the even as a freshman, when I had the least money probably I've ever had in my life, and the weekends, the food places are closed down on campus. You know what we didn't say? Well, man, if those streams were only open, we'd be able to feed ourselves. We went down to the local IGA and got the like 3-day-old meat that definitely expired the day before, and they changed the sticker. But you could get a giant round of ham for like $2.99.
Manager's special.
Yeah, exactly.
Look for that. It expired yesterday.
Giant tub of mac and cheese and mix in some ham, and that's what you ate, right? Like, you know. We weren't sitting around going like, oh, Jeeves, grab the Orvis. I need to go out and catch some brook trout to feed us.
It's hey, man, a human can live on real low quality coffee, rice, and chicken thighs for a very long time. And so can a dog. Ask me how I know.
I'll tell you what. This organization, they definitely are the champions of the impoverished. Their president is the CEO of Stanley Steamer. Which is a 2,500 employee, 150-year-old company. He was given, I'm just reading through his little outstanding achievements right now. Like, I don't know the guy personally. I don't know what his intentions are, but I don't think this is someone who's out there to save the working class people who just can't provide for themselves. So take that talking point out of your mouth. You're disgusting. And anyone in politics related to any other topic, if you're actually not working on something which is in the best interest of low-income people, weaponizing them as a talking point, you're a disgusting pig.
Well, also, I'm pretty sure at this point, Teddy Roosevelt's going to crawl out of the grave and punch him in the nose. Can I tell you a crazy story about, I gotta share this. I don't get to share this very often. So my family has a history with Teddy Roosevelt. So one of my great uncles, so like, the family kind of, you know, split, and half of them were in Louisiana and the other half moved to Texas. And I believe it was the Buckhorn Saloon. So one of my uncles was known as the Horn King of Texas because he had a bar and he would trade drinks with any cowboy who came in and said, hey, man, here's some horns, here's some antlers. And Teddy Roosevelt and the Rough Riders stopped by that bar and really Teddy Roosevelt fell in love with it. So there's this beautiful ornate chair made out of bull horns and cowhide that was in a lot of pictures that Teddy Roosevelt was in. And my uncle made that for him. My uncle's wife, my aunt, actually made this piece of art with rattlesnake rattles. You know, I can tell you beyond a shadow of a doubt that Teddy Roosevelt is the most conservation-minded president that we've ever had. He developed a national park system, which we still enjoy. And if you want to talk about the culture of America, doesn't matter where you're from, who you are, if you have the ability to get into a car or a bus or anything, you can go out and see how beautiful nature is, thanks to Teddy Roosevelt. And I think he'd shit his pants if he saw this right now and what these idiots were saying.
You're going to laugh your ass off, man. I'm going through their list of sponsors. It's a very short support our sponsors, okay? There is a light company, all right, whatever. Nothing fishing related. No.
Okay. I want to tell you, if anybody doesn't know the story of the teddy bear, they tied a bear to a tree and told Teddy Roosevelt to shoot it so they could get a picture of him with a bear. And he wouldn't do it because it was unsportsmanlike. And that's where the whole thing from the teddy bear, that's how we call it a goddamn teddy bear. All right.
Well, their first sponsor I clicked on is World Class Trophy Rooms and Taxidermy. And the highlighted animal that they have taxidermized on their homepage is a lion, both a male and a female. Okay, so the champions of the impoverished are lion hunting in Africa. Then I went up and clicked on, I'm not even going to say the name of the ranch because I don't know anything about them and there's nothing wrong with having a very nice place, but there's a hunting ranch which features giraffes walking around on the property and a massive, I don't know if that's like one of those gravity pools or whatever you call it, but a beautiful pool. And I actually typed in the, you know, basic estimations for their stays. And I'm seeing anywhere from $7,000 to $10,000 for a week in the small group suite, up to $15,000 for the large group residents on site. So you have $15,000 lodge stay in vacations. And then let's see here. We've got, to shoot that sheep on that big ass mountain, I know that's not cheap to get to. I mean, it has nothing. So you have what? The businesses of $15,000 1 week vacation so they can go shoot some animal or something like that. I'm not even hating on anyone that chooses, makes their money and uses the, use it whatever way they want to that's legal. The reality is you are not the champions of the working class people. There's not a single working class company on here. Not one. There's only about 12 of them. And all of them look like they need a lot of money to go shoot something really, really cool or really, really unique. Oh, here we go. Hosted trips to go hunt elk. That I don't even know how many points are on that elk. It looks like it's from Stranger Things. Holy shit. In New Zealand, Tony, you think that the impoverished of Maine?
It's probably a red stag if it's in New Zealand.
Well, whatever it is, all I'm seeing is I'm looking at this lodge as I know I could not afford 20 minutes to sneeze on the front doorstep. You know, it's just gross. Totally, totally gross. And the people of Maine and New England, if you've listened this far, go look into it a little bit and then let a friend know to let a friend know that this is stupidity and we shouldn't even put up with this. We should be disgusted that they're wasting our state resources when it's already an economically limited state. They have a lot of economic issues and stuff. You know, I got friends who are local and state level politicians up there or running to be so in various capacities. And that is a talking point with areas of Maine that do not have a lot of money. So weaponizing them because you want to be able to spin fish and kill. It's not even about spin fishing versus fly fishing. You just want to be able to kill more shit and you want less regulations. Go kick rocks, bro.
Yeah, I don't know, man. Like the funniest thing is we've talked for a half an hour about this and I'm sure some people listening to this know me. Most people don't. But Cody, correct me if I'm wrong. You've never hesitated to do that in our friendship and working relationship over the years, but you will never meet another person in your life who has more stronger feelings than me about leave me the F alone.
Very true.
Despise. My philosophy on life is if you're not hurting anyone, you do whatever the hell you want. If you are just leave people alone. I think that people are good in their heart and soul. And I think that you can push good people too far. And in my retirement, I am going to move to a place where I will be assured that I will be left the hell alone to do what I want on my property and nobody bothering me. And I can just be me. So look, I mean, that is my life. That is every part of who I am. What are you laughing about?
I clicked on their Become a Member page. Guess how much their annual membership is? $500 a year. But don't worry, you can round up your donation to $26.29 to cover the processing fees for them. Meanwhile, our membership is, $29 for the... I mean, you're at like $2.99 a month, less than just... Fucking ridiculous. It's
look,
a non-profit. Yeah,
I want to be real clear on my position on this stuff. The United States government bankrupted a house of ill refute. They actually owned a legal house of ill refute in a state where it's legal, and they bankrupted it. I believe that the government couldn't run a hot dog cart without ruining it. And I just want to be real clear on that. Like, but that said, like, it's real simple to me. You're a steward of the resource. If you enjoy the resource, whether it's hunting or fishing, you are a steward of that resource and you don't take more than you can use. I think that is just, when you boil it all down, that is the simplest thing in the world and you have to protect it. I think that the greatest thing about this country is that we are allowed to exercise our right to protect our natural resources. And I think that's why we still have natural resources. And, you know, to say that regulations are burdensome when it comes to that kind of stuff, well, as somebody who's in the trenches every day, I can tell you that getting a burdensome regulation is not that easy to do because of the uphill fight that you have every single time that you're trying to do the right thing for the resource. And to take that away in like one fell swoop is just, it's kind of unbelievable. And it's like opening up Pandora's box. Like, you don't know what the trickle down, the cascading effect of this is going to be. And that's all that I'm going to say about it. I it's so easy. Cody and I hear all the time, I mean, the names that we have been called, green decoys and environmental nut jobs and all this kind of shit. And it's like the funniest thing that I've ever heard. I mean, we laugh at it a lot because it's like, man, you don't know me very well, because I come from a place and time where, you know, we did live off of stuff. And, you know, it's just, if you love something, how do you not protect it? And how do you not, how in the course of your life have you not seen things go south, go really bad, and tell stories of what it was like 25 years ago? And we say this all the time, like, name one fishery that's better than it was 10 years ago. And you can't. So, you know, suggesting that at the level of efficiency that we operate now with all the technology that we have, that, you know, we're overly burdened by regulations, that's enough to make you want to, you know, put your head in a vise. So, Cody, real quick, we kind of left the Louisiana menhaden thing because it's a different jurisdiction, it's a different issue. But y'all, please look at the blog coming up right after the holiday, because the comment period is open until January 19th, I believe. And if they repeal the buffer zone, that's going to have to go to the state legislator, the legislators rather, in the oversight committee. And we'll probably all be in Louisiana telling them to not, please don't do this, because you can't regulate a fishery on how much a factory can produce. And that's pretty much how Louisiana manages menhaden right now. I'm trying to think, was there one other thing? God, I got to take my creatine, man. My brain is starting to melt here. So comment period is open January 19th for menhaden. The other thing, for all the bluefin tuna people out there, anytime that we get a hold of new science, anytime that we learn something new about a species, it's super exciting for us because it moves the ball forward. And don't know how this is going to pan out, but I'm pretty sure that the lab that Walt Gillette runs in Maine did some of this research on bluefin. I'm going to be honest, I haven't read the entire paper yet because my wife has had a honey-do list that makes the Herculean tasks look like sweeping the front porch. So I've been injured multiple times and my back feels like a slinky right now. So I haven't read the whole paper, but here's the gist. And I had spoken to Walt personally about this at the science symposium that we did up in Cape Cod, but this is really exciting stuff. So our knowledge of bluefin tuna was that at 8 years old, they go to the Gulf of Mexico and spawn, and they do trawl surveys in the Gulf of Mexico and catch, you know, a lot of bluefin tuna larvae. And the adult fish that they were catching were ready to go. You know, they had fertile eggs, sperm, all ready to go. They knew that spawning was occurring in the Gulf of Mexico. But recently, they have done some trawl surveys in the Slope Sea. The Slope Sea, just consider that, is the continental shelf off New England. And they did some trawl surveys, and guess what? They found bluefin tuna larvae. This is very exciting. You know, another spawning aggregation for bluefin tuna. And even more exciting, they found fish as young as 4 years old. not the 8-year-olds, not the big Mac daddies in the Gulf of Mexico. These fish were 4 years old that were ready to go, had fertile eggs, had sperm ready to go. So learning that about bluefin tuna, that there is another spawning area, that they do spawn earlier, that could have some real big management implications and a little bit of relief for the bluefin tuna fishery. We will monitor this information and keep y'all up to date on it, but it is peer reviewed. It is out there. I'll spend a little bit of time over New Year's reading through it, and we'll give y'all an update. But this is a case of science is telling us something that we did not know before. The science was performed in part, at least, by the lab, Walt Gillette's lab, who we know Walt. We know a lot of scientists at the lab. We hold them in the highest regard. And this could have real big implications in what the stock size looks like for Western Atlantic bluefin. And, you know, finding out that they spawn earlier than the larger fish in the Gulf of Mexico is profound. So this paper just came out. We're not sure of the implications yet, but it'll probably change things a little bit and, you know, potentially for the better. So that is something to take into 2026 for all of our bluefin tuna fishermen out there, that things are changing a little bit. We're learning a little bit more about the species. And, you know, I would be hard pressed to think that the quota would not go up a little bit learning this about another spawning area and the age structure of the spawning fish. So wanted to kind of leave on a little bit of a positive note, and we'll pay a lot of attention to it. And again, hopefully this will be good news for those fleets of anglers, you know, in New England.
Yeah, worth noting on the research. Excuse me. Worth noting on the two that I know if I say too much here, you'll probably kill me, but that we have some really cool stuff just on the horizon within sight. Some stuff that participate in, lead, take the charge, somewhere in between. But some really cool stuff for 2026.
Well, Cody,
there's no lack of need for really sound and profound research.
Yeah. So let's leave off on this too. You know, we're finishing up our ALBI work. The paper to talk about catch and release mortality and movements and a whole bunch of other things is in final peer review right now. So y'all should see that, you know, hopefully in the first quarter of 2026. We learned a lot about ALBIs. We need to, if you want to talk about like the successes of the association, we got great rules in North Carolina and Massachusetts. We're working on other states to copy those regulations on ALBIs and Bonito. We got a little bit of funding. We're going to be good at putting some acoustic tags in Atlantic Bonito in North Carolina again and in some areas of New England. So that's exciting. We're going to learn a little bit more about Atlantic Bonito because they've become more and more important over the past couple of years. We deployed a bunch of tags for Jack Crevalle with our team. They never really showed up in South Carolina this year, but we have some waiting for them.
I think we're almost at 70, Tony. I don't think we broke 70, but I think we're in upper 60s. And also a cool update here that I want to throw in, but we just got our first pings, right? Like these fish are moving around, and hopefully we already have a wealth of data from the 60-something that have been tagged. But it all comes down to when those receivers are pulled and when the data is downloaded and shared with the collaborative network. So there's a lag time in all those pings. But we did just hear from Aleha, our awesome scientist at FIU, saying like, hey, we have our first pings recorded from Jack. So some really exciting stuff for everyone who bought a sponsored Jack tag with their sight lines bands 1 through 45. Those will all get assigned to a tag number, especially... And for those who caught a fish with a guide and then chose to sponsor that tag, we'll make sure that you lined up with your tag number. But people are going to get reports, hopefully, I don't want to put a timeline on Aleja and mess her up, but somewhere early or mid 2026, hopefully we're going to start to find out where some of these fish are going to get to go. And the people that help make this project a reality, they're going to get to participate in a really cool way. So I'm excited to see that play out.
Yeah. And a special thanks to all of our guides, you know, from Florida, Mississippi, Alabama, Louisiana, Texas, because this tagging stuff is not easy. It slows you down. It slows your day down. It is tough to handle, you know, a big bruiser brawling fish and make sure you don't hurt it. You do your surgery on it, and none of it's easy, man. And it's a big deal, and our community has stepped up huge to get that done. So, you know, and thank you immensely to all the sponsors and all the people who bought bracelets, and we're moving the ball forward. And I would just, as a teaser, I would just say this, that we have two new projects that are on the docket for very, very high profile species, not kind of, you know, the Albies and the Bonito and the Jacks, and, you know, some people love them, some people hate them. Like, this is stuff that everyone loves. And we're super excited about it. And we haven't gotten the full proposal. We just have drafts. And we haven't raised all the money, which is pretty typical for us. And we're all incredibly nervous about doing this again. But, you know, we're moving into a realm of a little bit more. That doesn't mean that we're not going to protect the, you know, the backroom bar brawlers like Jacks and Albies, but we're moving into a realm of a little bit more high profile stuff. And, you know, when Cody and I sit down and talk about all this, it's pretty amazing because you see the need for science in these high profile species and you're just like, my goodness, like, why hadn't somebody done something about this? Like, what? Yeah, everybody's complaining. Everybody says we need to know this, we need to know that. And they cry and complain and wham, wham, wham. And nobody gets up and rolls their sleeves up and does it. And here we are again. Here we are again. You know, trying to raise money in the background to go to these projects to answer the questions. And you know, here's the craziest thing. We don't know what the answer is going to be. It may be something we don't want to hear. But you gotta know, you gotta, whether you want to hear it or not, we have to find out what's going on so we can make the best decisions possible. So we got a lot going on already in 2026. And I kind of told everyone to stand down, you know, right around Christmas Eve and paint your house and redo your bathroom because your wife's mad at you, and take your dog for a walk, and don't worry.
Like personal experience.
Yeah, it sounds like personal experience, doesn't it, Cody? Knock down half your house, you know, like, you know, and rebuild it. Look, I mean, right now, it's not like we're sitting around twiddling our thumbs, but we're doing a lot of stuff kind of in the background to prep for 2026. And we're going to give you people things to fight for and things to care about and an opportunity to make a difference. And when push comes to shove, that's all we can do. And that's it. As shitty as parts of 2025 were, there were still some really cool victories that we have. And, you know, tip of the cap to the state agencies in North Carolina and Massachusetts for helping us out. We hold them in very high regard with the regulations. And lots of exciting stuff potentially for 2026. And we're just going to keep rolling. And we need, whether you're a brook trout snob with a $2,500 fly rod who doesn't want any ruffians on your brook in Maine, to just a regular kid with, you don't have two nickels to rub together and you have dreams of catching a big fish, we're here for all of you. We care about you. We care about the resource. We're never going to stop working hard for you. We're going to give you information and you can love us or hate us. That's okay with us. And I'll tell you what, if you hated us in 2025, we're going to give you a lot of reason to hate us in 2026. So buckle up, Buttercup. You're not going to have a fun 2026.
I'm looking forward to it, man. We got We've got about 36 more hours to keep getting some house chores done. I will say, Tony, I got to go back to Home Depot again, but I secretly, I keep forgetting stuff on purpose because they put a Wahlburgers food truck in front of my Home Depot. And so you can leave with like a four-layered greasy cheese smash burger every time you go to get hardware. It's kind of dangerous. So,
dude,
if you don't hear from me, I am at the Wahlburgers in front of Home Depot, absolutely balling out.
Is it as good as Z Burger in DC?
Dude, it's hey, when you're a Boston boy by heart, if Mark Wahlberg sells something, you have to buy it. It's kind of just like part of the culture.
I am not a Boston boy by heart, but those Wahlburgers are pretty darn good. And I genuinely appreciate Mark Wahlberg, even though he has that awful accent.
Hey. Hey now. No smash.
But no, seriously, like there's a bakery next to the tile shop that I have to go to because I'm retiling. I don't even want to talk about it. But yeah, there's nothing like spending a pile of money on something to make your house a little bit better, and then potentially getting diabetes on the way home when you buy a cinnamon muffin that has, I don't know, half a bag of powdered sugar on it and is the size of a basketball. Guys are all the same. I don't care where you are. Yeah, so I found a good bakery next to the tile shop that I've been back and forth to half a dozen times over the holiday. And between the cake pops, the muffins, and those little three-layer Italian cookie Christmas cookies, my diet has gone off the effing rails.
So we'll need a new policy director when Tony's dead by July. So if anyone wants to put in their resumes, but I'll leave that to you, man, because, hey, shout out to Captain Daniel Andrews and everything he's done, not only just fighting the sugar industry and the regulation perspective, but convinced me to quit sugar, or didn't even convince me, inspired me to quit sugar, and I'm over 2 months completely sugar-free. So I will let you hold down the cake pops. Doesn't mean I'm the healthiest person, because I will still indulge in some Wahlburgers. But yeah, man, let's keep chugging. Good food, good tidings. Happy holidays to all. Happy New Year to everyone.
You're one of them enviro wackos, yeah, man. Exactly. No sugar. Like, what's wrong with you?
I think that makes you a domestic terrorist, I think. But
yeah.
All good, man. I'm really, really excited for what 2026 holds. So thank you to everyone who
just
held
remember
it down and survived
2026. Hey, listen, y'all. Make your black-eyed peas. It's good luck. Leave three on the side of your plate for New Year's Eve. If you don't know what I'm talking about, you're probably from Boston. But that's a Southern thing for good luck. And remember, be the bumblebee. Be the bumblebee. Don't convince those flies that honey's better than shit. Let them have their shit. Flies need shit. We want the honey.